Chapter 26, The Moral Twilight Zone. It was the late fall of 2007, and a group of Special Activities Division ground branch operators sat around a fire pit at a classified CIA facility in Kandahar called Gecko Base, wondering what to do about someone on their team, an Afghan fighter who they suspected was a double agent for the Taliban. Some of the ground branch operators felt that their lives were in danger. They were taking a vote on whether or not they should kill this indigenous fighter, who went by the name Saif Mohammed. The ground branch team called him Saif the Snake. Although this proposed killing had not been initiated from higher up, to an outside observer, the scenario feels reminiscent of the 1969 Green Beret affair in Vietnam. In the 6 years since the CIA had first deployed its paramilitary teams into Afghanistan, one element had significantly changed. The teams got ground branch heavy, a senior intelligence service officer who oversaw this expansion clarified for this book. The emphasis in Afghanistan and elsewhere was now on lethal direct action, which is what ground branch does best. Few people have ever gone on record to discuss ground branch activities. That ground branch trains indigenous fighters to go on kill or capture missions with them is an even more closely guarded secret. These soldiers were not part of the Afghan National Army, meaning they did not appear on any official books. They were paid by the CIA in cash every 2 weeks, according to the ground branch operators who relayed this story. In 2010, reporter Bob Woodward first identified these CIA-led indigenous force units as counterterrorism pursuit teams, but almost nothing substantive has been written about them since. No ground branch operations have appeared in any classified documents stolen by whistleblowers and leakers and subsequently published online. At most, occasionally, one finds a reference to OGA, Other Government Agency, a euphemism for the CIA. The idea of having indigenous soldiers fight alongside CIA paramilitary operators is a direct descendant of the Civilian Irregular Defense Group in Vietnam. Billy Hoa and others spent years teaching South Vietnamese Indig to sabotage, subvert, and kill Viet Cong. The goal was to train local fighters how to push back against the communists trying to take over their country so the Americans could leave. In Afghanistan, the paradigm was the same. The ground branch operators were here to train the Afghan Indig to sabotage, subvert, and kill Taliban who were trying to take over the country so the Americans could leave. But the Indig were also a White House mandate meant to serve as the so-called Afghan face, similar to how the Scorpions were meant to serve as the Arab face in Iraq. When a ground branch team raided a home or compound in search of a high-value target on a kill or capture list, the idea was that local civilians they ran into along the way would feel as if their own people were fighting this war, not the American CIA. At Gecko, many problems got solved around the fire pit. The pit was located just a few dozen yards away from where the ground branch operators lived, each man inside his own Connex shipping container, stacked too high. The Afghans lived separately in barracks down the road. Saif the Snake was one of the 80 or so Indig assigned to the unit. If the Taliban were to insert a mole inside a counterterrorism pursuit team at Gecko Base, the result would be catastrophic. The team could get ambushed on the way to or from a mission, or the base could get blown up with an IED. Part of the problem here at Gecko was the provenance of the Indij fighters. On most other CIA bases around Afghanistan, the Indij were independently screened before employment. But at Gecko, the Afghan soldiers were supplied to the CIA by Hamid Karzai's notoriously corrupt half-brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, a former restaurant owner who'd been living in America in Chicago until his brother became president. A neighbor in Chicago who owned the hot dog stand next to Ahmed Wali Karzai's restaurant recalls seeing him standing on a street corner the week the Taliban fell in December 2001. Ahmed Wali Karzai was carrying a suitcase and waiting for the bus. "Where are you going?" the neighbor asked. "Afghanistan," he replied. "My brother is president." Now, 6 years later, Ahmed Wali Karzai was in charge of Kandahar, the second largest city in Afghanistan. Since December 2001, Ahmed Wali Karzai had been living in Kandahar as a kind of mafia boss. His official title was chairman of the Kandahar Provincial Council, but everyone knew him to be emperor. Local newspapers called him the little president. To American infantry soldiers, he was the godfather. In a leaked, classified State Department cable, the ambassador's office informed Washington, "As the kingpin in Kandahar, the president's younger half-brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, AWK, dominates access to economic resources, patronage, and protection. The overriding purpose that unifies his political roles as chairman of the Kandahar Provincial Council and as the president's personal representative in the South is the enrichment, extension, and perpetuation of the Karzai clan." In Kandahar, it was the same old story repeating itself. Ahmed Wali Karzai was a corrupt, treacherous bad guy, but he was our bad guy. Like President Trujillo or the Shah, like the corrupt Diem brothers who'd been propped up by the CIA and the Defense Department in South Vietnam 45 years before. Ground branch operators recall seeing Ahmed Wali Karzai drop by the Gecko base, always with a posse of local bodyguards, sometimes as often as two or three times a week. "He always left with a suitcase full of cash," says a ground branch operator, call sign Hatchet. "We were absolutely convinced that AWK was the source of all evil in Kandahar," Lieutenant Colonel Keddy Davison, U.S. Military Intelligence Chief for the Kandahar Division, said in an interview with the Washington Post. But at the CIA's Gecko base, the State Department and the Defense Department were to accept what the CIA was attempting to accomplish with its hidden hand. Around the fire pit, the ground branch operators wondered what to do about the possible traitor, Saif the Snake. "He's called the Snake," one of the operators, call sign Shark, emphasized. Shark suggested that this was downright biblical. "That's just what we call him," someone else reminded Shark, and that they all used made-up call signs on a black program. The CIA chief of base at Gecko had been brought into the loop. Saif the Snake had been identified to him as a possible double agent. Two of the ground branch operators caught Saif sitting on a rooftop inside the compound, sketching a map of the base. Entrances and exits, who lived where, the location of the armory. When Saif was formally questioned, he said he liked to draw. There was more. Saif had been caught with a list of names of the Americans on base as well as the vehicle count, with numbers identifying each vehicle attached to the teams. He'd been seen with a cell phone on a mission. Cell phones were not allowed on missions. A traitor could phone in the team's location for an ambush. But the CIA's rules of engagement stated that you couldn't search the indigenous Afghan soldiers, same as you can't shoot a bad guy in the back, even if he's running away from a gunfight you were just having with him. On the operation where Saif Mohammed was seen with a phone, the team was ambushed. Two Afghan soldiers got blown up with an IED and lost limbs. One ground branch operator had been shot in the chest, his life saved by his body armor. All three soldiers were medevaced out and survived. Circumstantial evidence, one of the team guys said, of Saif's cell phone. There was another operator at Gecko who was concerned, a ground branch officer named Brian Ray Hoke. Hoke was young for ground branch, just 33. He was a kind of Renaissance man, a philosopher, poet, and warfighter in one. He had studied oceanography at the U.S. Naval Academy, ran marathons, played the violin. After college, he passed Hell Week and became an officer with the Navy SEALs, deployed to Europe and into the war theater in the Middle East. In 2004, Brian Hoke retired from the Navy SEALs and joined the clandestine service of the CIA, becoming a paramilitary operations officer in the Special Activities Division. He had a wife and three children at home in Virginia. He wanted to get home to see his kids. He'd been on a mission with Shark a few months back, where Saif the Snake had simply disappeared in the middle of a gunfight. Later, they found him sitting in one of the ground branch trucks. He said he was cold. A ground branch operator with the call sign Stingray was unconvinced Saif was a bad guy. No way, he insisted. Stingray had been at Gecko longer than anyone else on the team. He'd also been on missions with Saif the Snake. He may not be the best fighter, Stingray said. Hardly any of the Afghans were, but he was loyal. Shark remained unconvinced. This is not a tough one to figure out, he insisted. Saif Mohammed was a traitor who needed to be dealt with. There was too much to lose. Saif had already been reported to the National Directorate of Security, NDS, Afghanistan's equivalent of the CIA. He'd been questioned, released, and returned to Gecko Base. Everyone knows NDS is a kangaroo court, said another operator, call sign Axe. Besides, he'd been supplied to the CIA by Ahmed Wali Karzai, so he was protected. The ground branch operators had to wait it out, for now. Training the Afghan soldiers for the counterterrorism pursuit teams was its own secret nightmare, starting with the general incompatibility of the two groups' codes of conduct. Ground branch operators are among the most qualified and experienced Tier 1 and Tier 2 paramilitary operators in the United States. They have near-impeccable service records, no blemishes or black marks. The men must regularly pass a polygraph test, must be accountable to the CIA. If you fail your polygraph, you're out of ground branch for good. Ground branch officers and operators are high-level problem-solving warriors who operate in the most radical, non-permissive combat environments in the world. They must think clearly and act flawlessly in a 360-degree gunfight, in close-quarters combat, in ambush, hit-and-run, snatch-and-grab, and rescue operations. To infiltrate a target, they must be able to fast rope out of helicopters, perform halo and high-altitude, high-opening, hey-ho jumps out of airplanes, walk 12 kilometers or more behind enemy lines, carrying 75 pounds of gear or a wounded soldier. All of this must be performed in any terrain or temperature, on the top of a 10,000-foot mountain or in subsurface underwater environments such as an ocean or a river, from sub-zero freezing to 122-degree Fahrenheit heat. The operators need Olympian confidence and stamina when they go on killer capture missions and rescue operations. You must be completely amoral and completely moral at the same time, said a ground branch operator, call sign Lightning. Amoral meaning unconcerned with the rightness or the wrongness of something because the laws, rules, and codes you are operating inside have already been set by others, by lawmakers in the United States. You are doing what you are doing on the orders of POTUS, the President of the United States, says another operator, call sign Cheetah. Amoral must not be confused with immoral, Hatchett clarifies. Immoral means in violation of your moral code. The early days of the Taliban began right here in Kandahar at Gecko Base. When the Taliban took over Kabul in 1996, the CIA started keeping a file on the group's founder and supreme leader, a one-eyed mujahid from the Soviet war named Mullah Mohammed Omar. Not much is known about Mullah Omar, Deputy Chief of Mission John C. Holzman wrote in a classified cable to Langley. He formed the Taliban in late 1994 as a reaction against immoral local commanders who had raped several girls in their village outside Kandahar, Holzman wrote. Like many guerrilla warfare leaders before him, Mullah Omar's stated purpose was to rid the land of a corrupting and evil force. The way the narrative goes, Mullah Omar and several friends ambushed the suspected warlord rapist, executed him on the spot, then suspended his corpse from a tank barrel parked in the town square. Mullah Omar commandeered the town's radio and explained to the villagers why he and his friends had done what they'd done. The religion of Allah is being stepped on. The people are openly displaying evil. They steal the people's money. They attack their honor on the main street, Mullah Omar cried. They kill people and put them against the rocks on the side of the road, and the cars pass by and see the dead body. This was a horrible crime against Islam, and it was exactly what Mullah Omar had just done to his victim's body, the suspected warlord rapist. Clearly, the Taliban was not suggesting any kind of golden rule to begin with, the golden rule being, do unto others as you would do unto yourself. Omar's group claimed it would stand up against this corruption. Mullah Omar became popular. He took risks. Once, during a public speech on a rooftop, a gathering of the faithful in Kandahar, he pulled a holy relic, the cloak said to be worn by the Prophet Muhammad 1,500 years before, from a sacred holding place and draped it over his own shoulders, declaring himself the Emir of all Muslims. People in the crowds threw up their turbans to be blessed by it, observed a BBC reporter on hand to film the event. It was like being in some great religious ceremony in the Middle Ages. The action marked the beginning of Mullah Omar's rise to power. In less than 2 years, the Taliban seized Kabul. A spokesman for the Taliban attributed Mullah Omar's greatness to three traits regarded by the fundamental Islamists as admirable: his religious piety, his reputation for incorruptibility, and his bravery in the jihad. Under his supreme rule, the Taliban famously banned music, football, and kite flying. They cut off the hands of thieves and the fingers of women wearing nail polish. They cut off the heads of infidels, adulterers, and anyone caught carrying objectionable literature. Homosexuals were thrown off rooftops or tortured to death by a medieval practice of being buried under a mud and wattle wall until death comes by suffocation. Mullah Omar was renowned for his piety. He was said to sleep on cement floors and consume only broth and dry bread. But it did not take long for the supreme leader to become corrupt. Soon, he was driving around Afghanistan in a Land Rover and living in a garish palace, the one where the Ground Branch operators now lived. These luxuries, the fancy cars and the palace, were gifts given to Mullah Omar by his benefactor, Osama bin Laden. After bin Laden was kicked out of Sudan and arrived in Afghanistan in 1996, the Al-Qaeda leader moved his family to Kandahar and pledged loyalty to Mullah Omar. In exchange, bin Laden was allowed to operate his terrorist training camps in the country, including one called Tarnak Farms in Kandahar and another called the Lion's Den in Khost. The Kandahar palace that bin Laden built for Mullah Omar was a tawdry affair. It had gold-plated chandeliers and murals of waterfalls and mud hut villages painted on its cheap formica walls. Canadian soldiers who fought alongside Ground Branch operators called it Graceland for its Elvis-level kitsch. There was a private mosque with a mirrored minaret, stables for horses and camels, a water fountain, and a swimming pool. Mullah Omar occupied it until sometime before October 19, 2001, when an unusually large 30-man Delta Force team conducted an airborne assault on the palace with the intent of killing or capturing Mullah Omar. Four Chinook helicopters set down inside the palace walls and unloaded the Delta operators, several all-terrain vehicles, ATVs, and 60 U.S. Army Rangers assigned to secure the perimeter. The palace compound was huge, roughly 5 kilometers in diameter, and the ATVs unloaded from the Chinooks helped the Delta operators quickly secure the compound. The fortress had been built up against a mountain into which a warren of caves had been carved. Some had showers and squat toilets, U.S. forces discovered. The original assault on the compound was a Defense Department operation. After a 4-hour search of the palace, the Delta operators and the Rangers were ambushed by Taliban armed with rocket-propelled grenades and were extracted from the compound under fire. An American was injured during the firefight, reportedly losing a foot to an RPG, and one of the Chinooks lost a piece of its landing gear after getting hit. Mullah Omar was nowhere to be found. The CIA later learned that the one-eyed leader of the Taliban, together with his top commanders, had fled into Pakistan to regroup. The Taliban government that boasted piety, incorruptibility, and bravery left behind in its wake one of the most immoral, corrupt, criminal, debauched societies the modern world has ever known. Civil order had been destroyed. Adults left traumatized and brutalized, writes Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid in Taliban. Children rootless without identity or reason to live except to fight. In the words of Lakhdar Brahimi, a former United Nations diplomat, "We are dealing with a failed state which looks like an infected wound. You don't even know where to begin cleaning it." Now, 6 years later, in 2007, very little had changed. Michael Hayden, as director of the CIA, audaciously called Afghanistan still the good war, despite everything that was known about how dire the situation was, how security for Afghans had gotten worse, not better. In 6 years, the Americans had set up the Karzai government in Kabul and established the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, to train Afghan National Security Forces, ANSF. The ANSF was supposed to assist in rebuilding key government institutions while fighting the Taliban insurgency. But in reality, by the time 2007 came to a close, civil society had devolved into anarchy and terror that rivaled what it was like before the Americans arrived. Improvised explosive devices were introduced into the pandemonium, detonated in mosques, at schools, on roads, and at sporting events. The year 2007 marked the most violent year in Afghanistan since the Americans had arrived, with 1,120 IED attacks in Kandahar alone. The birthplace of the Taliban was now the most violent province in the country. For ground branch operators, the violence was one element, but two issues that no one ever talks about kept getting in the way. These were moral center issues, says Axe, using a decidedly Western term. Moral wounds of war, says a ground branch operator, call sign Spear. Things no one wants to discuss, adds Cheetah. Cutting to the chase, says another operator, call sign Samson, Afghanistan is a moral twilight zone, a mix of horror, psychological thriller, suspense, and things so strange it feels like science fiction. All usually end up with a macabre, dark, and evil twist. There are new episodes daily, Cheetah recalls. You never have to watch reruns. It's like the Alice in Wonderland book I read to my kids, says a ground branch operator, call sign Hawk. He quotes Lewis Carroll. If you don't know where you're going, all roads will lead you there. Hello, darkness, my old friend, says Axe, recalling a lyric from the 60s. In Afghanistan, you are confronted with evil situations you think can't be outperformed, but then they are, explains Shark. There's the moral twilight zone outside the wire and inside the wire, he says. But sometimes the evil and wickedness shows up directly at the front gate. Shark relays the story of an indigenous Afghan soldier named Asadallah who requested 3 days off to walk to a wedding 12 kilometers away. The CIA chief of base said fine. Asadallah came back in two separate pieces, recalls Shark. His head had been separated from his body. They left him at the front gate. Shark volunteered to go get the body. Accompanying him was a medic who'd graduated from West Point. The medic wanted to do an autopsy, find out how Asadallah died. I said, isn't it obvious? They cut off his head. Shark found the moral twilight zone unbearable at times. Sometimes you can deal with it, other times you cannot. A 27-year veteran of the U.S. Special Forces, with nearly a decade spent on a Tier 1 team, Shark's Spartan warrior values sometimes brought him into conflict with the behavior and actions of the Afghan soldiers he was training. Yes, some were exceptionally brave soldiers, he says. Of the 500 to 600 fighters Shark trained and fought alongside over a 5-year period in Afghanistan, 3 of the soldiers were like brothers to him. By 2007, when the meeting took place around the fire pit, Shark and a colleague had already been awarded one of the CIA's highest medals for a voluntary act of courage performed under hazardous conditions and with grave risk to one's own life. During an ambush by the Taliban, the two operators had saved the life of an Afghan teammate whose limb had been blown off by a grenade. Honored for courage under fire, Shark and his colleague had been flown back to the United States to receive the award. All they had were their operator clothes. Shark's ex-wife FedExed a suit to his hotel. The two ground branch operators had their pictures taken, were given their medals, and were told that everything would be locked away in a vault until some future date. There was always the question when or if programs would get declassified. MACV's SOG operators had to wait more than 30 years for it to happen. By then, says Axe, the public has forgotten, and the real issues are no longer anyone's concern. Cheetah points out that headlines appearing in the U.S. press occasionally refer to assassination teams being run by the CIA. We operate under Title 50 rules, says Hatchet. The indige we train and the bad guys we kill live in a world where there are no rules except kill. Outstanding Afghan fighters were rare among those trained for joint indige-CIA operations. Most of them are high on opium a lot of the time, a fact reiterated by every ground branch operator interviewed for this book. 8 out of 10 soldiers were illiterate. Many had trouble counting beyond 30. When it came time to train indigenous bodyguards for President Karzai's security detail, he objected to having CIA and Delta Force operators only, concerned it made him look bad. Each applicant was required to fill out a questionnaire. According to the Washington Post's Joshua Partlow, all but one of the Afghan recruits handed the paper back blank. Only one in the entire group of applicants could read. Karzai's recruiter sought to hire the man, but the others in the group objected. "He's our teacher in the village," they told Karzai's recruiter. "If we give him to you, we won't have anyone to teach our children." On occasion, during heavy snows, when some of the CIA's more remote forward operating bases got snowed in, Shark tried teaching math to the indigenous fighters. "This was not math 101," he says. "This was first grade math." Once, in an effort to explain conceptually how big numbers and long distances work, Shark took a group of soldiers outside to look at the full moon rising up over the Hindu Kush Mountains. "I said to them, 'So the moon is 250,000 miles away.' And while I was on the subject, I said, 'By the way, we landed there 50 years ago. The missions were called Apollo.' One of the soldiers said, 'That's impossible.' He pointed to the moon and said, 'The moon's too small to land people on.'" Welcome to the Twilight Zone. A lot of them were so stoned so much of the time it looked like they'd been swimming in a heavily chlorinated pool, says Spear. "A few hours before we'd go out on a mission, I'd personally go into their barracks and confiscate their pipes," says Shark. "Make them turn over their drugs until we were done fighting. Fighting bad guys high on drugs is a really bad idea," says Axe. "They do it," says Hatchet. "We're told to accept it. It's how it is." The other problem, says Shark, was that they seemed to spend all their free time raping each other in their barracks, a fact confirmed with 10 ground branch operators interviewed. "We had a code. If I needed them, I'd knock loud on the door to indicate they needed to wrap it up and knock it off, but they ignored that." "It's disgusting," says Hatchet. "They do it. We had to accept it. We're told it's how it is. Some of them rape underage boys." Ken Stiles, who set up the CIA's geographic information system for Hank Crumpton in the basement of Langley in the first weeks of the war, confirmed that rape was said to be a cultural norm. Stiles was sent to Kabul to set up an in-country electronic targeting system for the CIA. On occasion, he was flown to FOBs in the war zone. "I once asked an Afghan soldier why he joined special forces as opposed to the regular army," recalls Stiles. He said, "Because in special forces, you get raped less." Why was this not reported more thoroughly in the press? 4 months after the war started, the New York Times ran an article entitled, "Kandahar Journal, Shh, It's an Open Secret, Warlords and Pedophilia." Then, the press went silent for almost 15 years. The raping problem was endemic to all Afghan military forces. It would later be revealed, not just within the indigenous forces being trained by the CIA. By 2007, ISAF consisted of approximately 55,100 personnel from 39 countries, including 23,220 troops from the United States. And yet, conspicuously missing from the constant rush of war reports were any about Afghan soldiers raping each other and raping and enslaving young boys. Not until 2018 would the U.S. Inspector General produce a devastating report exposing 5,753 cases of gross human rights abuses by Afghan forces, including the routine enslavement and rape of underage boys by Afghan commanders. What about the Leahy Amendment, which cuts off U.S. aid to foreign military units that commit human rights abuses? Erica Gaston of the nonprofit organization Afghanistan Analyst Network explains. There is a blanket waiver in the DoD version that allows the Secretary of Defense to waive the Leahy Law in extraordinary circumstances, implicitly where serious national security interests are involved. As an example, Gaston cites Kandahar. Are the ground branch operators correct in their assessment that Afghanistan is the moral twilight zone? And what does this have to do with assassination as a political tool? In a rare, authorized interview in 2011, a Green Beret captain identified as Matt told the Christian Science Monitor, "The ugly reality is that if the U.S. wants to prevail against the Taliban and its allies, it must work with Afghan fighters whose behavior insults Western sensibilities. There are no good guys by our standards. There is no standard to begin with. There is no justice system or rule of law to hold people accountable." No justice system, no rule of law, nothing to hold people accountable. $2 trillion U.S. dollars spent in Afghanistan in more than 17 years of war, not including veterans' health costs. Every U.S. president has options. When diplomacy fails and war is not or is no longer an option, the president can exercise the third option, the CIA's hidden hand. But to what end? To understand the rest of this story, what the ground branch operators proposed to do about the suspected double agent in the ranks, and to evaluate it objectively, it's important to comprehend how profoundly secret and compartmentalized the world of a ground branch operator really is. As specific and singular as this situation may seem, no ground branch operations in Afghanistan have been made public. For ground branch operators, secrecy and anonymity override every mission. Ground branch operators work under pseudonyms and regularly change their aliases. They travel into the war theater using a CIA-engineered second passport that has given them an identity separate from the one with which they were born. The different name, different address, even different parents within the backstory are all elements and attributes of the CIA's hidden hand. An operator who uses the pseudonym David Smith at Gecko might go by Richard White at Jalalabad or Jeff Hill at Coast. And there is another identity that exists within personnel services at CIA headquarters, a consistent identity that chronologically keeps track of each operator's assignments as they accumulate. This pseudonym usually ascribes a false ethnicity to the operator. For example, an Irish Catholic ground branch operator from Wisconsin might be identified in the central database as Danny Noradian, as if he's Armenian-American, or Peter Andropoulos, as if he's Greek-American. Billy Waugh's database identity made him sound Chinese-American. If a ground branch operator who works as a contract employee, a green badger, is audited by the Internal Revenue Service, they must follow stringent protocols to ensure that their true employer, the CIA, is never revealed. An equally complex problem arises if a gunshot wound endured in the war theater gets infected back home. U.S. doctors are required to report gunshot wounds to administrators, and patients are required to truthfully explain how they got their injuries. The general rule among ground branch operators with regard to an infected wound is to say to the hospital doctor, "I shot myself hunting." But this becomes a problem when it happens more than once. If a ground branch operator is killed in action overseas, his body is sent to a refrigerator located at the nearest CIA station. There, the dead man waits. Only when the ground branch operator's in true passport is sent from the CIA can the soldier's physical body be repatriated to the United States. Spouse, children, and other family members are not told the circumstances in which their loved one died. Nate Chapman's family had no idea he was on a Special Activities Division ground branch team until 2015, when the CIA awarded him a star on its marble memorial wall. Identity in Afghanistan for Afghan nationals is as strange as it is complex. Having a proper identity is everybody's human right, says Najibullah Hameen, a child protection specialist with UNICEF in Kabul. This is something which is lacking in Afghanistan. Less than 1% of the population have a birth certificate. Even if the government started issuing birth certificates, the Afghan government is incapable of registering and storing this information, says Hameen. If you ask an Afghan soldier how old he is, says a ground branch operator, everyone will tell you he is 25. Some of the 25-year-olds look 18, some of them look 50, but they're all just 25. They don't think of time the way we think of time, says Hatchett. It's fight, fuck, eat, sleep, fight, fuck, repeat. Kind of like us, says Cheetah, half joking. Blood is a major issue. Most civilians don't know offhand what their blood type is, but for a combat soldier in the war theater, this information is critical. Almost everyone needs a blood bag at some point or another, says Axe. For this reason, before each mission, ground branch operators write their blood type in indelible ink on their body armor and their skin. The blood problem is bigger than this, says Shark. Because of all the man-on-man sex, many of the fighters have Hep B. If someone looked into how much Cipro is given out to Afghan fighters, that would be a story right there, says Cheetah. Setting aside what anyone thinks about the sexual behavior, says Shark, the real problem is blood-on-blood contact between fighters on the battlefield. When an Afghan soldier named Taj Mohammed had his leg blown off on a killer capture mission, Shark worked quickly to get a tourniquet on him before he bled out. But Shark had also been hit by grenade frag and was also bleeding, meaning that the two soldiers had blood-on-blood contact on the battlefield while Shark was trying to save Taj's life. According to a declassified government report, the Afghan National Army does not have the supplies or equipment to test for blood type and requires new recruits to go to a doctor and pay to have their blood tested without reimbursement. Almost no one does this. As a result, a suspiciously large number of soldiers were reported to have the same blood type, and everybody was 25 years old. What to do about Saif Mohammed, the traitor at Gecko Base? The consensus around the fire pit was, wait, gather evidence. Shark accepted the Ground Branch team's decision. Everything that happened here had to be agreed upon by the team. Then, just a few weeks later, two team members from the Canadian unit brought hard evidence to the Ground Branch team. They had a folder. Inside the folder was a photograph. In the photograph, there was Saif the Snake, yakking it up with known Taliban leaders in Pakistan. Saif Mohammed was most certainly a traitor. Something had to be done. There was a vote on the table. Why not just kill him? But timing is everything, and before anything could be done about Saif the Snake, the chief of base at Gecko approached the team. "Something's come up," he said. "Something's come up" was a euphemism for there's a kill or capture mission on the board. Everything on these kinds of missions was extremely time-sensitive. Once a high-value target was found and his location had been fixed, the movement to finish the individual had to happen fast. This is how the CIA's action arm has worked since the War on Terror began. Direct action missions were fraught with peril and consequence, potentially good and potentially very bad. Potential positive strategic effects of HVT operations include eroding insurgent effectiveness, weakening insurgent will, reducing the level of insurgent support, fragmenting or splitting the insurgent group, altering insurgent strategy, reads a leaked CIA directive on high-value targeting operations. On the downside, potential negative effects of HVT operations include increasing the level of insurgent support, strengthening an armed group's bond with the population, creating a vacuum into which more radical groups can enter, and escalating or de-escalating a conflict in ways that favor the insurgents. The devil was always in the details of the mission, as the Ground Branch team at Gecko soon learned. A top Taliban commander and high-value target was holed up in a compound in Sangin, 87 miles to the northwest of Gecko base. With him were three accomplices, also HVTs. This Taliban commander was responsible for financing, building, and placing IEDs on area roads. Scores of coalition forces and hundreds of Afghan civilians were dead because of his IEDs. Just weeks before, a suicide bomber had blown himself up at a dogfighting competition in Kandahar, killing 80 people and wounding 100, the deadliest attack since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. The commander's location had been fixed. His pattern of life suggested he'd leave Sangin at dawn. "These were the same guys we'd gone after before," recalls Shark. The fact that they'd popped up was huge. A decision had to be made to go or not. The team had 2 hours to decide. The team gathered in the Tactical Operations Center, a huge room with high ceilings and a sand table. The mission was heavily debated. A consensus had to be reached. The Taliban compound was standard for the region, square, made of mud walls, and with several inside rooms, a back courtyard with a variety of vehicles. It was likely that bomb-making materials were stored there. Using GPS coordinates, the team was to travel to a specific location. This would be the vehicle drop-off point. They would exit the vehicles, set security, and send two teams out to assault the target. They had more than enough Ground Branch guys, augmented with Tier 1 operators on loan to the CIA. The Canadian operators were on standby as backup, as was a Quick Reaction Force, QRF, in the area. An AC-130 Spectre gunship would be with the team overhead for the movement there. There would be a short gap with no coverage, then A-10 Thunderbolts flying overhead on the way home. The gear was set. the QRF was set. The primary negative was that there weren't any helicopters available to infiltrate the target with the ground branch team. This meant that the team had to drive to Sangin in a 12-vehicle convoy on a cratered-out, muddy, rutty, single-lane road that was hard to navigate due to recent heavy rains. One way in, one way out, on a road notorious for ambushes and IEDs. Finally, a consensus was reached. The operators agreed to accept the mission. Everyone plugged the coordinates of the target area into their GPS systems. Shark jumped on a motorcycle and headed down to brief the Afghan soldiers at their barracks. We always gave the Indij the edited version of our plan for our safety, says Ground Branch operator Drew Dwyer. Never specifics of where we were going. A 10-year veteran of the Special Activities Division, Dwyer's first ground branch mission was in 2002, and he has participated in covert action operations on all five continents. Using a sandbox, the team showed the Afghan soldiers the basic layout of the target area in Sangin. After the briefing, the soldiers were told to have their vehicles in convoy formation lined up at the gate. They had 20 minutes. Soon, they would set out through Kandahar, through the land of IEDs.